Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
I'll be chatting to Erica Drum to find out how we can eat in season and how to forage for wild garlic. Have you ever thought you might have been raised by a narcissist? I'll be meeting two psychotherapists and experts on the subject to tell you how you'll know and what to do about it. And should we lower the screening age for bowel cancer? So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? An absolutely mad couple of weeks of spinning plates, work stuff, family stuff, home stuff. We've had a communion. Well, three communions, if you add in the cousins, a vow renewal, my sister-in-law and her hubby, not us this time, several trips to a podiatrist with a child's ingrown toenail, a glasses prescription for the other one, back to the first one with an astro burn to the leg, a race day, and then all the usual bits and pieces in between, and you can get some idea of what it has been like. Look, in there, of course, were gorgeous moments, the sunshine, the family fun. It's been lovely, but it has been full on. The mental load of hairdresser appointments, bouncy castle liaising and supermarket sweeping for the guests has now moved on, and I am definitely ready to fill my head with less. My favourite aunt is staying with us at the moment, and this week is going to be walks, lounging, chatting to her and dinners out, and I am 100% here for it. Speaking of race day, I loved hosting the event at Leopardstown in Dublin for Breast Cancer Ireland. We have come so far with cancer research. So many diagnosed now go on to live with the disease and to live well, but there is still a way to go. So I got dressed up, donned a headpiece and had a lovely day in aid of Breast Cancer Ireland with lots of lovely people, and so much money was raised. I always love to meet up with the team, with the ambassadors. Many have been guests on the show to tell their story of breast cancer diagnosis. They are an amazing bunch of women. And I said on the podium, getting to know them, I have learned that while there are, of course, dark and difficult days with cancer, there is also room for friendship and fun. And I witness that in spades when I'm around them. Belly laughs among the tears and some incredible strength and support. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Erica Drum joins me in studio now to talk about food in season and what you can make with it. You're very welcome back, Erica.
Thank you, Claire. Great to see you.
I can't believe it's been so many months. Like, it was January the last time
I know
you were in. We were talking about Veganuary with Holly White. So February, animal produce came back. Have you been different in any way since?
That's so true. I've always been quite a high veg eater, you know, lots of veg and lots of stuff. But I think I appreciate my cheese and butter a bit more, even though I always did. And I've definitely reduced my meat. I never had a huge craving for big pieces of meat and stuff. But I'm really loving cooking more veggies, particularly for my daughter as well, because you might be a little bit worried when you don't put meat into their meals. But I've learned from Veganuary where I can get protein and other things from vegetable sources. So, like, as they say, what do the cows eat? You know, they eat the grass. So I've figured it all out a little bit for myself. It's obviously different for everybody. So,
yeah, I mean, again, I'm not a dietitian, and obviously you have to be careful with proteins, yes, especially for growing kids. But I always think of the gorillas. Do you ever see them? And they're just eating like big heads of broccoli, and they're the most muscular. Same with rhinos. There's so many veggies in the animal kingdom. But look, maybe we're a bit different, but it definitely taught you something about how you eat and what you eat.
Certainly, like, I wouldn't have paid attention to protein and stuff in the past, or really noticed, and I did notice when I was hungry, you know, I realised that that's where I was lacking. So I figured it, that's what I mean when I say I figured it out for myself, that I'd have to have beans or whatever to replace that. So.
And eggs, you were saying you missed as well, so were you happy to bring those back? Because they are handy. Eggs and toast is like a handy number.
It's the handiest, most satiating, quickest meal, I find. And you know, if you're in a rush, which I often am these days, it's a quick one and I love it. Yeah, eggs in every format, scrambled, fried, everything, omelets, tarts, whatever, you name it.
And you had a bit of a trip of a lifetime recently. You were in Jamaica.
Yeah, were you watching me?
I was watching your stories with interest. Was it a friend's birthday? Because I was like, I need to become friends with this person. What a house. What a birthday party. What a setup.
I know. He's fantastic. My friend Peter, who went over to work for an Irish company called Digicel there 15 years ago. And he's just finished with them, actually. So it was kind of a retirement of that and his 40th. And yeah, Jamaica's incredible. You know, it's paradise, really. And it's a jungle on the ocean. You know, you literally are in the jungly trees in the forest and then you're walking out to the sea. It's just gorgeous. Yeah, bliss.
And what sort of food were you eating?
So actually, I probably ate quite a lot of Western food, but using the local produce. But some bits and bobs that were local, like plantain or, you know, curried goat is something that they eat quite a lot over there. And I took a bag home of the curry powder, of the specific spice blend of curry powder from Jamaica, because they would have had a lot of influence from around the world, particularly. And curry goat, they eat conch, which is the big shell. They'll eat the inside of that. You know, the one that you put up your ear.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd like that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's nice.
Slimy.
It's slightly chewy, actually. Yeah.
Squidish, I suppose.
Yeah, a little calamari-ish. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then just things like their fresh fruit and vegetables, like you're picking mango. The mangoes were falling off the trees. Like no one could go hungry in Jamaica in April, May, because literally the mangoes, like, it would hit your head as you walk normal streets. But, you know, not many people will be out and about walking too much because it's so hot. But if you were to be in the garden or walking around, the mangoes are just falling off. They're so delicious. Different than any you'd get here.
Yeah, because they haven't got on a plane and been in a crate and been refrigerated for such a long amount of time. So you're getting them at their best.
Yeah, and you're nearly eating them warm on purpose, you know, when they fall off. Like, because they'll fall. It's the same with anything. They'll fall when they're at their prime of ripeness. So it's just incredible. Bananas, plantain, green bananas, which is different to plantain and different to bananas. This is what they would cook. You know, you'd fry them. We'd have them with our breakfast, with our the scrambled eggs. They'd eat a lot over there as well. But, you know, things like that. There's a thing called ackee, which is quite a famous and specifically Jamaican kind of fruit tree that they chop up. And it kind of looks like scrambled eggs, actually. And that's something that they would have. Everyone would eat it, you know, from kids to grandparents. It's really yummy.
And I love that you said you brought home a bag of the curry spice because then you got stuck in the States, whatever way your flights worked. And like you were asking people for advice on what supermarkets should you go to. I love a supermarket when I'm away. And you were picking up things that you can't necessarily get. And I think that's a really smart thing to do, particularly when it comes to spice mixes. Yeah. And you don't want to be weighing yourself down now with too much, but
no,
is that something you do everywhere you go?
Everywhere I go, and I'd recommend it to everybody, especially people who are into cooking and changing, you know, to having something new and being kind of experimental. But for me, it's like my absolute joy. Like, I know a lot of women like to go shopping in clothes shops and stuff. Dave at one point was like, Erica, we're here for another 4 hours in America and you're going to spend it in a supermarket. I'm like, damn right I'm going to spend it in the supermarket. But they're huge, Claire. Like, they have everything. You know, they're just absolute. You know, they have this thing called everything but the bagel seasoning. Do you know this seasoning?
No.
It's over here now and people are making it and I've made it and different people have recipes for it. But it's seasoning that has everything but the actual bagel. So the idea that you're eating a bagel, so it will give you the flavours of a bagel, like poppy seeds, sesame seeds, garlic, onion powder, all that. So they have like six different variations of this in the supermarkets, or sauces and stuff. It got me thinking, you know, of brands and ideas for me in the future of maybe bringing out products and stuff. And that's what I was really honing in on, was looking at all the design as well. They're just like, we've always said they're ahead of us. If we, you know, as kids, do you remember, like, get sweets from America? It was so exciting. But like, we are ahead in so many other ways. But yeah, some things, they are kind of cooler nearly.
Yeah, a few spice mixes and, you know, we went on a trip around America and we went from San Francisco to LA and then we still had to go to Vegas. And I spent most of our money in the Whole Foods market. Like, we were literally had no money in Vegas because I had spent like $70 getting salads and bits and bobs. So like, it's crazy and it's easily done. It is easily done.
It's expensive, isn't it?
It can be, but I wouldn't be looking at non-perishables that I could have brought home. I would never have thought about that because I kind of think, can't we get everything now? And can't we get all the spice mixes? But you think there's always something to keep your eye out for?
Yeah, I think so. And like, just for fun as well, to bring it home. Like, that was something as a kid. I always loved my uncle from America. Brendan would come over with sweets. But now I'm like, what can, like the spice mix from Jamaica. I maybe could buy it here, but, you know, I'm delighted I've brought that home now because I can have the taste of Jamaica at home, maybe with goat or lamb or something that's similar, you know, something like that.
Yeah, so to bring a little bit of the holiday flavours home. So look, the season has changed and I just think our eating really changes at this time of year. There's lots more salads, it's kind of lighter fare. Hopefully we get to eat in the garden a little bit more. So what's in season and what should we be throwing in our basket?
100%. I think that's actually innate in us. I don't, it is probably a physiological thing, but actually it's just... we feel lighter, right? We've less clothes on us, less things to carry, less. You know, we don't need the comfort of big pasta bowls or stews or all that. So at the moment, we're still a little, not lacking, but because it's May, say spring stuff will take a while and we haven't had the best weather the past few months. So we're looking at more stuff coming in June, July, August, September particularly. But at the moment, we've still got the stores of, you know, your root vegetables. They'll always kind of be stored over the winter months. But we've got things like rhubarb. You know, I love my foraging, my Irish stuff that really is seasonal. So rhubarb is only a few months of the year and it's so tasty. Elderflower, we just spoke about that last year. I do think you went picking it and you made your...
I didn't rinse it first. I think that was a problem.
Well, you could soak it, you could rinse it, but like at the same time nature does it too, you know, with the rain and whatever else. Was there loads of bits?
Yeah, it wasn't great. Now it was a bit off.
Okay.
It was a little bit off. All my family were like, oh, okay. So I think I need to go again. Okay, I think with all of these things you need to just keep refining and getting it right. So I think I'd give a bit more of a soak, and I think I had a few that were a bit too far gone.
Okay, well that could have easily changed. That's like cat pee flavour smell.
We'd bottles of cat pee.
Yeah.
We actually had cat pee cordial. You're so right. That's exactly what we had.
Okay, so my recipe wasn't to fault. It was actually the fact that you picked dead flowers.
It was me. Because you're like, yay, look, these are the flowers. You get really excited that you've recognised elderflower. Yeah. You're foraging and then you just get it wrong. So like, don't get the really open flowers.
No, and actually I have a highlight of it on my Instagram, and if anyone wants to look at it, check it out. And this year, when I go foraging, I will do more of an in-depth detail of not to do this and to do that, to whatever. Other things we have is beetroot, carrots, they're all here. Spinach and spring greens are all coming in. So, you know, there's a good bit to get these days. Gooseberries, which I don't get very often. I don't think you can find, but if anyone's lucky enough to have a gooseberry tree, you're getting them at the moment.
And you brought me in some wild garlic pesto. Now, I'd say... There could be danger in foraging for this as well. What do we need to look for if we're going?
It's actually just towards the end, which you can still get it, right? And particularly, we know Clare being in Howth, there's loads up in Howth. It likes kind of foresty land, and you'll see it with big white flowers. But there's also three-cornered leek, which we see on the sides of the roads quite a lot, and that's got white flowers also, but that's more grassy-like. And then wild garlic is a flat, long, tall leaf. But once the flowers have died, I wouldn't really pick it like your elderflower. Not the same smell, but it's not as great. So I keep saying the past few weeks, we're at the end. But actually, with the way the weather has been, it's a bit of a delayed finish this year. So you could probably still pick it. Flat, green leaves. If they've gone in any way yellow, I wouldn't waste them. And another thing you could do, actually, and it's no harm unless you're taking loads, but it's no harm to wherever it's growing it, is dig. Bring a spoon. You don't even need a shovel. And just dig. Once the flowers are dead, dig down about 4 to 5 inches, 6 inches maybe, and pull up the roots of a bunch and bring it home and pop it into a pot because it spreads. So pop it into a pot of soil and forget about it. Put it in a shady area in your garden till next spring and you'll have your own.
And wild garlic pesto is the same as any pesto. Yeah. You throw it on pasta, roast veg, same way as you'd use any pesto.
Yeah, and it is quite strong. So if you're going to, I would always recommend if you're going to eat it with friends, as in let them eat it too.
Okay.
But I've brought that because I have a gorgeous spring upside down tart recipe for you. So it's putting all your veggies onto a tray first. I don't know if you've seen this. It's kind of a TikTok trend at the moment. It's silly. But it's amazing because it works, right? So you put all your spring veggies. We've got asparagus at the moment. It's really gorgeous. Some scallions and your olive oil, your salt and pepper. And then you get your piece of puff pastry and you smear that with what I've done is wild garlic pesto. That's the recipe I've up, but you could use any pesto. And cream cheese. So kind of even amount of the two onto the puff pastry. And then you put the wet side, the pesto side of the pastry, onto the veggies. So the pastry is upwards. So that's why it's upside down, right? Egg wash onto your pastry, a few sesame seeds or whatever you want, into the oven. So you're getting a really puffy, crunchy pastry base, right? So when it comes out, chopping board on top and flip. And all your, if you need to line it actually when you start, I should have said that with greaseproof paper. So all your veggies will fall back down onto this really crispy puff pastry. And you have the most delicious tart. You can sprinkle it with some feta cheese or something. And it's gorgeous spring tart with salad. The thing is, when you have a puff pastry tart, I don't know if you have experienced this, you get a soggy bottom. And it always happens, especially if you've got loads of lovely veggies that have moisture in them. That goes into the bottom of your pastry and it holds and then doesn't really get crispy. And all you get is the crispy edge and you're dying for a bit of crispy edge. Whereas this tart's just gorgeous. It's crispy all over.
And impressive, I think, to bring out to a table and not actually that much effort to it. Okay, I absolutely love
not
that.
Not at all.
You're going to be at Bloom at the end of the month.
I am. I'm so excited to be at Bloom. It is like, for your show, Claire, talking about wellness and health and, you know, obviously I'm talking about food and Bloom is about food, but it's about growing and being with nature, I suppose. It is just the most well-feeling festival, I think. You know, all of them are great crack and having drinks or, you know, music and stuff. But it just, the flowers and the positivity in the air and the smell, and it's just such a fabulous festival. So yes, I will be on the main stage for the first time. So I'm excited at 4:15 on Friday. But I'm also on a smaller stage called Horticulture is Life on Friday and Saturday at 1:00.
Absolutely love it. And I do. I remember going down years ago when I first started presenting this show and there was a whole space dedicated to a mental health charity and the importance of getting out in nature. And it really flipped it for me. It's not just for seasoned gardeners. There's something there for everyone. So I would definitely recommend Bloom. And where can people find you online?
On my Instagram page, please. Erica Drum, Erica with a C, Drum with one M, I-E.
Perfect. Thanks, Erica Drum. Thank you very much as always.
Thanks, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, the Marie Keating Foundation is making an urgent call to government to reduce the age of bowel cancer screening from 59 to 50, as the charity highlights that one in five diagnoses is to someone under the age of 60. The No Regrets campaign urges those under the screening age of 59 not to dismiss symptoms and to get checked by a GP if they noticed any changes at all. I'm joined in studio by Dr. Fiona Macken, a Dublin-based GP supporting the call for lowering the screening age, and Brendan Donlan from Kildare, a No Regrets ambassador. Well, you're both very welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to have us.
Brendan, I'll start with you if I could. Tell us your story to being diagnosed with bowel cancer.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm one of the 10% of patients who gets it under 50, in that I was 48 years old and I had no real symptoms to speak of until I wandered into the ER department clutching my stomach and saying, I feel very unwell. And that's the challenge with this, is that it's quite an insidious little cancer. It tends to grow in your insides and give you quite vague, quite hard, hard to pin down, easy to dismiss symptoms. But I was, it doesn't sound like it now, but I was lucky in that I got a complete bowel blockage. So I got pain like nothing I've ever experienced, and I instantly knew something is wrong. And so my wife brought me down to the A&E department and we queued up and we got triage and the whole shebang. And as soon as they saw me looking like a large pregnant lady, because I basically was swelling up because nothing, not even gas could escape my stomach. It was completely blocked by the tumour. And they said, right, we'll scan you and see what's going on. And it was a Friday evening before the bank holiday weekend, exactly 6 years ago, actually. And they said, as soon as they saw the scan, they said, right, well, there's something in the way and we have to get rid of it. And we have to open you up now, because if we don't relieve this pressure, you'll get a rupture and it could kill you. So I was exceptionally lucky that there was a colorectal surgeon on duty that night in the hospital. And he said, well, you've been fasting already, so let's do this now. And I was brought in that evening and I had around a foot and a half of my colon taken out. I was very lucky in that they were able to join it back together again, because most people end up with an ostomy bag after this procedure, but mine was very stretchy, so they could put it back together. And at the end of my week in hospital, they were able to confirm, having sent my samples to the lab, that it was definitely a tumour, and they knew that it had spread beyond the bowel walls into lymph nodes, but luckily not beyond the lymph nodes as far as they could tell. And this is the interesting part of this, is that when you get this kind of diagnosis, you think, you know, you doctors are all-knowing goddesses and gods, and you know everything that's happening. And I remember looking at the staging of my tumour, and it was full of X's. I said, what do the X's mean? It says, we don't know yet. because there's so many reasons why, because you came in so quickly and we didn't have a chance to, you know, do all the normal tests we do. So we just cut it out to save your life. And now we have to wait and see through scans and time, where else might this cancer be? And luckily, in my case, the answer was nowhere but where they'd found it. And then once I was healed, which was a long enough process, around 6 to 8 weeks before I could sort of walk around again and be like another normal person, they then put a port inside my chest and they lined me up for 6 months of chemo. And I had 6 months of chemo and I was then checked at the end of it. And the great news was at that point they knew it hadn't come back and they couldn't find any evidence of cancer anywhere else, which was two brilliant pieces of news. And then over the last 5.5 years, I've been checked at recurring intervals. So first every 6 months, then every year, then every year and a half. And I had my final check just around 4 or 5 weeks ago. And I'm now officially, because I'm past 5 years, I'm officially cancer free.
Well, congratulations. And, you know, that's really incredible. And as you say, there were certain parts along the way that you were perhaps luckier than others. But it's still a big shock to go from I have a pain in my tummy to I have cancer.
Yes.
You're not expecting that. But looking back now, knowing what you know, there were a couple of symptoms.
There were, and this was great. I met a really good registrar in the hospital, in the NE department, who was actually studying medical communication, and he saw I was a communications professional. So while I was sitting there in the A&E ward being triaged and clutching my stomach and saying, I don't feel well, he was talking about, you know, what it might be, and he was talking about how he could explain it to me, and he said, does this explanation make sense? And yeah, I mean, he said, so surely you must have had symptoms. This couldn't have got this big inside of you without you knowing of this. And I said, well, I mean, over the last sort of 6 months, yes, I've been tired. And yes, I've had less energy. And yes, I have struggled to retain weight. I mean, it's funny, when you're 48, you're normally trying to lose weight. And I was trying to do a couch to 5K very slowly and very unsuccessfully, considering I was growing a sort of a 1 foot large tumor inside of me. And the weight was falling off me. People were going, God, that's amazing. That running stuff does great treat. And I was like, yeah, but I'm getting slower every time I run. So I was tired and I was, you know, really struggling with energy, but vague stuff, you know, nothing you would put down to anything other than work and, you know, stress, really. The only immediate alarm bell symptoms I had were around 3 or 4 days before I walked into A&E. And that was when and forgive the graphicness of this, but the one advantage of bowel cancer is if you do have a physical symptom you can keep an eye on, which is what your poop looks like. And in my case, I didn't have blood, but it was getting progressively thinner because literally my bowel was being closed off as the tumor grew. And so it was becoming like a toothpaste. It was getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And in concurrence with that, and he said, this is the real giveaway sign that people tend to ignore because they joke about it. My stomach noises were so loud, we had to turn up the television to hear dialogue. Like we were getting these rumbling and whistling noises. It was like a kettle. Because literally the whole thing was like under a pressure cooker because it was so stuck that it was trying to get past this obstruction. And it was making these whistling, gurgly noises that were unlike anything I've ever heard. And we laughed about it. It's like the cat would run away from the sofa when it made this noise. And we laughed. He said, those two signs together are go to the doctor immediately signs. He said, people talk about blood and that's obviously a real game changer. You need to go to your doctor with the blood, but often it's hemorrhoids and other much more benign things. But when you have that loud stomach noises and your poop is getting thinner, that means you have an obstruction. And there's very few things that cause that obstruction that don't need immediate attention.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I want to bring you in, Dr. Fiona Macken, because Brendan has explained it so beautifully and eloquently. And people don't want to talk about what happens in the bathroom. And yet it is something that's going on in our body every single day, hopefully. And it's something we can keep an eye on. And any change there, we often think, oh, I'm stressed. Oh, I didn't eat well. Oh, I didn't. Like, life happens. But if we're starting to feel different, we should make an appointment to see you, shouldn't we?
Absolutely. And one of the things I would say to the patients all the time is they quite often will say, oh, I'm a bit embarrassed about this. And I'll say to them, well, I have to talk about poo and wee and these things all the time. So it's the same to me as it is your arm or your leg and what's going on. So to put people at their ease that they can talk about what's going on and not be embarrassed, because we as doctors are used to these conversations all the time and we're interested in what goes on. With those things that we can keep an eye on. So not to be embarrassed.
And we do tend to go round life on autopilot a little bit, don't we? That we are busy and life is, there's a lot going on. So that could be the reason you're tired. That could be the reason you're not feeling yourself because you're a little bit stressed. But we need to be having a little self-check-in on a weekly basis, perhaps writing something down, even in the notes in our phone, that over a month we're like, okay, again, might be a call to the GP. And I think a lot of people feel GPs are under a lot of pressure at the moment. They are. It's hard to get an appointment. But even book one for 3-4 weeks in advance.
Yeah, absolutely. The time that's on the guidelines for us would be if someone has an altered bowel habit for more than 6 weeks, that's something that we should be paying attention to. So that, because irritable bowel syndrome will cause us to have problems with gurgly noises in our stomach, with changes in our bowel habit. It's caused by stress. So to have persistent changes, so the changes in your bowel habit for longer than 6 weeks, not just something that was here today and gone tomorrow. But my feeling is that if someone is worried about symptoms they have in their body, then the doctor should be listening to them.
Yeah, most definitely. If you don't find one, you know and trust in that you can get to see, find another one. I often say it on the show. I think it's a really important health and wellness tip.
Yep.
What about the screening then? Because obviously if Brendan had have been screened, that would have been picked up early. And yes, he's lucky he's cancer free. But the earlier with all cancers, the earlier we have the detection, the quicker the treatment and the better the outcome.
Absolutely. And our difficulty now is that the research would have shown that this was a cancer of older people. And therefore, that would have been what we thought. And so the screening program was for older. We're trying to get the screening down to 50. But even if we got the screening down to 50, we wouldn't have picked up Brendan's cancer. So really getting it down to 50 is really only the start for these cancers, because now they're presenting in younger people. It's not a disease of over 60s anymore. It's a disease that we're seeing in younger people like Brendan, who was only 48 when 48. He was diagnosed.
The risk of getting this cancer under 50 in Ireland has doubled in the last 20 years. And that's totally unprecedented, and it's reflected all over the world.
And do we know why that is? I mean, I hate to kind of attribute reasons as if, you know, could Brendan have been eating better? Like, I'm not saying that. Cancer can happen to anyone at any time. But do we know what's influencing this change in the statistics?
We don't seem to know. But it's definitely the last study day I was at in a major Dublin hospital, they were aware of it. And they wanted to make sure the GPs knew that bowel cancer was presenting in much younger people.
And it sounds like you're quite a health conscious kind of guy anyway, Brendan. I mean, you were doing the couch to 5K, you were doing all the right things. So it can happen to anyone at any time. You just really need to be watching your own body.
You do need to be watching your own body, and you do need to be an advocate for your own health. I mean, it's funny, I'm self-employed, so I'm really conscious that I can't afford to get sick. So I have these regular checkups, and I had in my diary for 2 years' time to start getting screened for bowel cancer. And ironically, when I was in hospital in the week when I was healing, in America, they then lowered the age to 48. And I was like, oh, for God's sake. You know? like literally, the Cancer Society and the Surgeon General in the US said it should be 45. And that's what they said in 2018. So I would have been caught. And the big advantage is that this is a totally preventable cancer, because when they screen you, they can determine, okay, something's not quite right. Let's do a colonoscopy and see what it might be. And when they do the colonoscopy, they can not only confirm if something's off, they can remove the beginnings of a cancer during the scope. So it's an incredibly good cancer in terms of the fact that it's easy to spot and easy to treat, but only through screening.
I can't believe you had that scheduled in. That's how organized you are. I'm very, very impressed. Well, it's great to see you so healthy and thriving and such a fantastic ambassador for the No Regrets campaign. Continued health and success to you, Brendan. Thank you very much for coming on. That's Brendan Donlan there. And just to reiterate, GP Fiona Macken, any changes, contact your GP. That's your first port of call.
Absolutely. And just say to them that you're worried that there's something going on. Be your own advocate and say to your doctor, could this be cancer?
And there's a petition that people can sign. Tell us more about that.
Yes, there is. If I could ask listeners to go to mariekeating.ie, there's a link there to a petition which we're running to try and persuade the HSE to lower the screening age to 50. Because at the moment it's 59, which is a phenomenal gap from where best practice says we should be screening from. So we need as many signatures as possible to try and make this happen. Thank you.
Brendan Donlan and Dr. Fiona Macken, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
And you're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, if you often felt as a child like you were the adult in the house, being a mini parent, a therapist, a confidant, and a mediator, chances are you may have been raised by a narcissist. Psychotherapists Katie McKenna and Helen Villers are experts on the subject, and in their book, You're Not the Problem, they hope to give understanding and advice. They both join me on the line now. Well, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
This was such an interesting book. And in the introduction, you both sort of talk about how narcissism has become this buzzword. And in many ways, it's great that we're breaking down stigma and that we're talking more. But there is a risk involved in that, isn't there, Helen, that we start to oversimplify something that's very complex and perhaps use it in the wrong way. Is that part of the reason you wanted to write this book?
Well, I think you're right. There is a risk of using it too much. But what I think is really important is to remember that we've all got narcissistic traits. So the question is whether or not they're healthy or unhealthy. And healthy narcissism is what drives us, gives us motivation to go for the promotion, to get a bigger house, a holiday or whatever, you know. So healthy narcissism is actually really helpful. What we're talking about is unhealthy narcissistic traits, which are very toxic and actually very damaging too.
And you've chosen to really do a deep dive into children of narcissists. Katie, tell us a bit about that decision to focus on that area.
What we look at is where this starts, where when somebody enters into an abusive relationship in adulthood, in a relationship with a narcissist or has been used and exploited in their friendships, we look back at this thread and see where was this normalized? Where did this child learn that actually that control was love?
And it's so interesting, you have case studies, you've changed the people's names, but you have real case studies to give examples as you go through each chapter of seeing this in action, of how it's playing out in life now and how it played out when they were children. Before we get into that a little bit, Helen, can you explain to people what narcissistic personality disorder is?
Yeah, absolutely. So narcissistic personality disorder is characterized by five main traits that we would see. Those are grandiosity, entitlement, exploitation, motivational empathy, and impaired self-awareness. And that means basically that grandiosity is where somebody thinks that they're the best thing that ever happened to the world. And, you know, we all know those people who are like the big I am, that they, if you've been to Tenerife, they've been to 11 a reef. And then entitlement is where somebody is just taking everything that they want because they feel that they have it. Exploitation feeds the entitlement. I'll use people to get what I want. And then motivational empathy, making you feel bad for either holding them accountable. You know, it's that guilt tripping thing, pulling on the heartstrings. And that impaired self-awareness is knowing enough to know what they're doing is wrong because they know to hide it, but not enough to care about the impact or why they need to do those things.
And coupled with that is a feeling that nothing is ever good enough. So even though you have this sense of self-worth and this grandiosity, nothing ever really measures up to those standards. And that's where it can get really tricky for the other person in this relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that therefore means that people are always feeling less than when they're around somebody with NPD, and it destroys their autonomy. And then so think about a child growing up with a parent who's always saying, you're not good enough, and the impact of that being absolutely devastating.
And Katie, how does someone become a narcissist?
This is such a good question, and this can trip people up, or really it can elicit guilt for them holding people accountable, because firstly, it's unknown, but what it's thought is that it's born from their own trauma. So what we're looking at here is the generational trauma, the impact being passed down. And a lot of the children growing up in this environment, one of the things we talk about in You're Not the Problem is how the narcissist parentifies their children. So typically they will know the difficulties that the parent had. And it is this reason how they kind of justify it and excuse their behavior, because they had it so hard. So what we talk about is that we can have empathy for their trauma, what they endured, but that it doesn't excuse the behavior.
And I thought that was really interesting because a lot of the case studies that you spoke about said, you know, my parent had a really tough upbringing. You would have thought they would have known better. But it's that sort of learned behavior when you don't have the skills, you can't bring it into the next generation. And yet you have the next generation showing up in clinic looking for help because they are feeling disconnected and lonely. So we are getting to a point of breaking the cycle.
This is the difference then between kind of learned behavior that we learn growing up and the difference between narcissistic behavior. What Helen talked about there with the impaired self-awareness. So a narcissist will be able to typically recognize how bad their parent was, but they won't then reflect and say, oh, well, I made mistakes and I was wrong and therefore I need to change. They will think, well, if you have a problem, that's your problem. Or if you have a problem with me, how dare you say that to me? I must be the worst person in the world.
Yeah. And there was a case study in the book. I think it was Jack, because I think he's one of the only men you have in the book. And, you know, he had quite an absent father growing up and he really felt that. And yet he took on that role when he had his own family, that he was constantly working and not really around at home, that it can be very hard for us to separate the experience we had that we bring into our own families. Why does that happen, Helen?
Because of relational patterns. So what we're talking about is that what we learn in childhood as normal, we then take into adulthood as normal. And so we repeat the behaviors until we realize, actually, this isn't helpful and it's not good for myself. It's not good for my relationships and it's certainly not good for my children. And then we start trying to undo it, which is what Katie was talking about. Those clients who have that self-awareness to kind of go, I don't want to be the same as my parent. I want to do things differently. And I have to unlearn those things that they taught me were absolutely normal.
Yeah. And that's where these kind of conversations, you know, are making a difference because people are stopping and saying, I don't need to feel like this. I don't want to feel like this. And there is more acceptance of people receiving professional help with that. And I think it's a really positive thing. Let's talk a bit then about the cycle of abuse from a narcissist, because I thought that was very interesting, from love bombing all the way to hoovering. Can you talk us through that a little, Helen?
Sure, absolutely. So the cycle of abuse, I love this question, by the way, because this is what normalizes or exposes the behavior, because then people kind of go, oh, this is what's been happening to me. So the cycle of abuse is starting with love bombing, this kind of idealization on this epic scale, but on a foundation of nothing, really. So they don't know that you're amazing, but they're telling you that you are. And you may well be, but they just don't know that yet. And then that, once they've got you kind of hooked into that feeling of, wow, this is amazing, I feel so seen, they start something called breadcrumbing, which then builds the trauma bond, which makes it so hard to leave these relationships. And then we're followed by gaslighting, which is an umbrella term for lots of different behavior. And then we go into what's called the discard phase, where they kind of drop you out of nowhere. You've done something to upset you, and then suddenly they stop talking to you, and it's meant to elicit panic to make you kind of chase after them, fawn after them. And then when they've decided they want you back, they start something called hoovering. And that could be that they say something nice, oh, I miss you so much, and you know, or they send you a gift. But it also could be beating you into a fight. So they're saying, you're the worst thing that ever happened, blah. And so I think that's a really important distinction. And then that then goes back to love bombing again.
And Katie, when we have been exposed to trauma like this, and I think it's important we start having this conversation. I mean, even at the start of the book, you both point out that we've started to speak more about physical abuse and we've started to speak more about sexual abuse. And now we need to start also talking about long-term emotional abuse, because you might not exhibit the same visible scars, but it is having the same amount of damage. Because when your self-esteem is on the floor, it's harder for you to recognize this sort of behavior and to speak up for yourself and to get yourself out of this situation.
Absolutely. There's two things we look for when somebody grows up in an environment like this, and that's hyperdependence and hyperindependence. Hyperindependence is keeping people at arm's length, having a difficulty trusting others, having a difficulty asking for help. Hyperdependence is having a fear of saying no, constantly trying to please others, always apologizing. And typically people will think that this is my personality, this is just who I am. Whereas what happens is this happens from growing up in an environment where you've had to walk on eggshells, where you've had to anticipate another person's and your parents' behavior in order to keep yourself safe.
Yeah, and you know, that's why the book is called You're Not the Problem, because you start to take that on, that it must be something that you have done, that, you know, you're the drama, you're the problem. And if you had handled things in a different way, and it must be a very difficult story to break, especially when it's a parent or a partner or somebody that you love, to cut those ties and set those boundaries for yourself can be very tricky.
Yeah. It can be really hard. It's recognize what you're talking about there is the grief when we're in one of these relationships, because often people come into therapy and they're trying to figure out actually how they can communicate better. Like, I'm having difficulty in this relationship. How can I communicate better? How can I get them to understand me? Whereas when you learn actually this person, no matter how well you're articulating yourself, doesn't want to listen. They don't want to accept that accountability. They're deflecting, constantly moving off topic, gaslighting you, denying your reality, making you doubt and question your perception and your own reality. There's a huge grief for the person that you had wanted and who you hoped they would be and the person that you deserved.
Yeah, Helen, talk to us a bit about the fog, because I think it's a really good acronym, because it really describes that difficulty people have in finding their way out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. The fog is the fear, obligation and guilt. And a child will have those feelings, those emotions weaponized against them from childhood to force them to be silent, to not complain, to not criticize, not to fight back, not to rebel. And they will be obliged to meet their parents' needs over their own for the fear of being the worst person in the world, for making them feel terrible and guilty. You know, it's really exploiting a child's need to feel close and like a good child to their parent, to keep that relationship secure. But that then, of course, gets taken into adulthood. And a lot of people in abusive relationships will also be experiencing the fog massively.
So the second half of the book, after getting that sort of understanding and empowering the reader to really take a look at who they are and what they want and what they don't want and set up those boundaries, it's the way out. And can we talk a little bit about that? Because as I've already alluded to, there are times where you're still going to want that person to be in your life, especially if they are your parent and you have to navigate life alongside them with your blinkers off. Can you talk a little bit about how somebody sets about doing that, Helen?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to notice that this is hard, that it's really, really a very difficult road to walk, that somebody who makes a choice to go no contact has asked for respect and kindness, just general boundaries, very bare minimum stuff over and over again, and it's constantly and consistently being denied. But I think one of the best ways in order to kind of navigate these relationships or find where you want to be in those relationships is to work on your sense of self. And so that's why we've included identity building exercises, coping with rejection exercises, really trying to learn who you are in You're Not the Problem, instead of how to manage the other person, because that's what we've been doing the whole time. So now let's focus on ourselves and who we are so that we know we're making decisions for ourselves rather than for the person that has NPD or is behaving toxically towards us.
And Katie, there has to be an element, as we've already alluded to, of compassion here, that there may have been something in that person's life that led to this, and people do the best they can with what they have in the situation. So I want to say that, because my next question is, what if there's somebody listening who feels they are the narcissist? What's your advice to them?
Typically, if somebody is listening and they are the narcissist, they will be looking at this again, how it benefited them, how they got as far as they did, or they will be sitting in victimhood again to avoid being held accountable. So this is just me and I can't change. I think what, again, is really important to remember is, as Helen said right back at the beginning, we all have narcissistic traits, and the difference is what's healthy and unhealthy. And that when somebody has learned behavior, we can unlearn them because we care about the impact of other people. When we say to somebody that is healthy in a relationship, if somebody says to them, "What you did hurt me, you know, I was impacted by what you did," the person wants to reflect and look and talk and communicate and work towards resolving and repairing the relationship. The narcissist would never.
Yeah. And that's the difference, isn't it? It's that looking to repair. I mean, we all make mistakes in relationships. Yes. But it's about that need and that want to repair and that self-awareness within ourselves that there were times we didn't behave as perhaps we should have, and owning that.
And that's the difference with, you said it perfectly there, we all make mistakes. As parents and as humans, we're going to make mistakes. And again, somebody that grows up in this environment can have such a perfectionist standard because they've been punished so much. They've been given silent treatment, being stonewalled, you know, either that aggressive rage if they didn't do what was expected of them, that guilt tripping, or that silent, seething rage where the parent, you know, withdraws that love and affection from them. So they can have such high standards and have such a critical internal voice for them to meet these standards. Whereas what we're actually talking about is exactly that, being able to make mistakes because we're human and being able to repair them in the relationship and have self-compassion.
And I know, Helen, every situation is going to be different, but if the children of narcissistic parents have then brought those same behaviours into their adult relationships because that's what felt familiar and safe. Are there ways to heal and move through this? Because I think some people get afraid that they're going to have to end their marriages, end their relationships. Or does this advice just empower them to move differently through the world?
Well, that's exactly it. I think you've just hit the nail on the head. What we're trying to show people is you may well have some behaviours that you have learnt to be normal and that they are actually wounding to you and those around you, but to have compassion for self in it, and you can heal them. You can change them. It's not easy. It's hard. It means you've got to do a lot of self-reflection and self-acceptance, but it is possible and actually leads to having healthier relationships as a result, which is only going to be a great thing, you know. But yeah, it's very difficult, but worth it.
Yeah, and there is lots of insight, you know, from both Helen and Katie in their profession. But through the case studies, you really get an understanding. I found it a fascinating read, as well as practical strategies for healing. It's called You're Not the Problem, The Impact of Narcissism and Emotional Abuse and How to Heal. Helen Villers and Katie McKenna, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And that book, You're Not the Problem, is available now. So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.